Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Victoria Lloyd Barlow about her literary novel, All the Little Bird Hearts. Victoria has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Kent and has an extensive personal, professional and academic experience relating to autism. Like her novel's protagonist, Victoria is autistic. She has presented her doctoral research internationally, most recently speaking at Harvard University on autism and literary narrative. Victoria lives with her husband and children on the coast of northeast Kent. In this episode, we discuss writing from the perspective of an autistic woman as an autistic author herself, how she left school without qualifications before studying for a PhD in later life, and her advice for neurodiverse authors navigating the publishing industry. But first, here's Victoria with an excerpt from All the Little Bird Hearts.
I have always lived here, so I know the end of summer brings flames to the fields. I am drawn to watch after each harvest, as the farm workers set child-sized fires to consume what is barren on the land. The smoke rushes down to the gardens below, and it is rotten but sweet with knowing. And every year I repeat, Brucia latera to myself. This is the way Italians describe the intensity with which Sicilians work their land, burn the earth. I whisper this as softly as a prayer, to make the fires seem good and pure. The post-harvest burnings taught me how fire can be mistaken for light and can call to you in the same way. When my eyes are acclimatized to the sunlight, I noticed the small dark-haired woman lying on the lawn next door. The house was a holiday home, owned by Tom and his wife, who visited each summer and for occasional long weekends. Locals did not typically take to the summer people, whose numbers had increased in recent years. But Tom was affable enough to remain outside this category. He had three children. All were so close together in age that for several years it had seemed he was bringing the same unchanged baby back, and that the infants who toddled uncertainly behind him were the real newcomers. Tom's wife was fair-haired and as soft-bodied and sweet-faced as a child herself. The woman in the garden was none of these things. Her obliviousness to my gaze immediately moved me. She was on her back with her arms and legs spread out to a degree that looked unnatural, as though she'd fallen from a real height or been positioned unconscious by someone else entirely. Here was the pleasure of observation without the ambiguity of eye contact, which costs but never confirms what you're being promised or refused. I once watched my baby daughter like this, while she floated easily on her back across the screen of a scanning machine. I have loved you longest, I would tell Dolly when I felt sentimental, making my case in a contest that she did not in any case care to enter. I knew you first, I said, over and over to my daughter. I watched you, loved you before you ever saw me. I spoke first to her watchful baby face, and later I addressed her composed woman face with the same tender and misplaced ownership. Her eyes remained unchanged with age. Always, she was suspicious and scrupulous in equal measure.
Hi, Victoria. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast with me today to discuss your debut novel, All the Little Bird Hearts.
Hi, Chloe. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to talk to you about it.
So can you start by introducing the novel to us and telling us what All the Little Bird Hearts is about?
Yeah, sure. So the book's set in the mid-1980s, and it's narrated by a single mother called Sunday, who lives in the Lake District with her 16-year-old daughter, Dolly. A glamorous couple from London move in next door, and they bewitch the two women over one summer, which eventually results in enormous changes for all four of them.
And these neighbours that arrive are kind of instantly disruptive to Sunday's life. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your kind of inspiration for the novel, because I read that, I mean, you are an autistic writer yourself, and you've talked about how you felt that in fiction, particularly, that kind of authentic autistic life is underrepresented. And I was wondering whether that was your starting point for this novel, or was it something else?
In some ways, that was the starting point. The important thing for me was that I had an autistic narrator and protagonist, and that she would be speaking in the first person voice. So her experience would be really core to the book, and the reader would get a sense of that from the protagonist rather than from an observer. So that was important to me. My practical starting point for the novel was a place we used to live in a village which had farmland surrounding the village. We lived in a valley, and I picked the children up from school, and every year there was agricultural fires on the farmland around the school. And one day I was watching the fires, waiting for the children to come out, and their fire always made me feel like they were quite beautiful, the fires, but also kind of menacing in like a Wicker Man kind of way, because it felt like a sort of ritual that no one spoke about, but we just watched every year. And so I was watching the fire, and I mentioned to a couple of the other moms who were waiting about how strange I found the fire, and wasn't it spooky and menacing? And nobody agreed at all. No one thought they were at all strange. They were just a normal part of life. And I thought, well, that's really interesting that I feel very strongly about them and no one else is having this experience. And so I took that experience into the novel, and I wanted Sunday to be someone who really considered her own experiences and didn't just absorb what everyone else felt and thought, but actually really examined her own feelings and her own perspective. So that was another starting point. That was more of a practical starting point, with looking at the fires and the way that I interpreted them. Yeah, that was another starting point for me for the book.
Yeah, I really love Sunday as a character, and I've kind of over the years seen this trend kind of popping up of characters who are maybe neurodivergent or kind of seen as the kind of quirky comedic character, that they're almost portrayed as the oddball, the odd one out who can't quite connect socially. But Sunday, because she's written by you, is written so authentically and honestly. And I think that really helps as a reader to read a character that feels so believable. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about who Sunday is, what she's about, and also your experience of creating this character.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about autism for me is the interiority of the condition. It's an experience that's profoundly an inner experience. And yet the predominant theories about ASC are largely those made by neurotypical people. So that's purely on observation and data rather than experience. And I find many of those theories entirely foreign to my own experience of autism. So it was really important to me to write as an autistic person and to narrate an experience that is authentic. I know when I'm reading, the work that I find most relatable, whether it's fiction or factual, regarding autism, is written by autistic people. And that to me feels much more relatable when I'm reading it. It feels more important to me. And it was important to me in the book that Sunday demonstrated both the challenges and the beauty of autism. So I didn't want her to have an experience that was entirely without struggle. I also wanted her to have moments of joy through her condition. And that's something I tried to use within the book. One of the important things for me with Sunday was that she would have a job that she loved and was good at, and that she found real peace in and was capable at doing, because I think about 21% of autistic people are in employment. So lots of us are unemployed, and those of us who are employed, that quarter of people are underemployed due to that, you know, as far as the capabilities go. And I really wanted Sunday to show how capable she was and how much joy her job brings her, because that's so vital to her life and would be to so many people if they could access that.
And what you've said there about wanting to bring that authenticity, and because it's written in your voice, we often hear discussions about kind of own voices writing, and there's always a debate about, you know, who should write certain characters. But I think the beauty of own voices writing and writing from an experience that you have yourself is that you're including details that no one else would get, no one else would quite capture. And I think you did that beautifully. I'm thinking particularly about Sundays, when she's choosing her food, when she's selecting things to eat. That's something that I don't think a neurotypical person would pick up on or necessarily write about. But the way you've captured it gives those of us who don't experience that kind of life a real insight into not only what it's like to live with autism, but also to be in Sunday's head as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you feel that way, because those things are challenging to write about at first because it feels quite exposing. But then I think it's important to have those things out there that other people can relate to, and maybe they're autistic, maybe they're autism adjacent, but it just gives more of a feeling of what it's like and what the experience is like. So yeah, it was really at first challenging to write about those things, but then yeah, it became more important to me during the writing of the book.
So tell us about Vita then, who arrives in a bit of a whirlwind, this glamorous next door neighbour that Sunday has to, I was going to say put up with, but there's certainly a kind of friendship and a kinship at first. So tell us about Vita, tell us about kind of what conflict she brings to the story.
Vita, I actually really enjoyed hearing her come to life in the audible version of the book, because the actress does a great job with Vita's accent and the way she speaks, and that was really entertaining to hear. In fact, with Vita, the fires that I spoke about earlier with you, the fires around the village, were kind of where Vita came from. There's the first chapter of the book is called Fire Can Be Mistaken for Light, and the idea is that fire can be mistaken for light and can call to you in the same way that light does. And for me, Vita is very much that fire. She initially is very appealing, and Sunday, as many people do, feel drawn to her. But then actually, Vita's got the capacity to burn as well as be beautiful. So when I was writing about Vita, I was always thinking about those fires. And in many ways, Vita works as an opposite to Sunday, because Sunday is more socially awkward and introverted, and she looks up to Vita as somebody she would like to be, somebody who's charming, you know, gifted at communication. But then over the course of the book, Sunday comes to see that Vita's intentions are very much about self-interest rather than the people around her. And I think hopefully the readers feel that, without giving any spoilers away, that towards the end of the book, they feel Sunday is actually relieved that she's not like Vita, like she doesn't have the charm, but she has a more natural way of being with people, and that a way of connecting that's more authentic, even if it's not going to charm a room full of people. It's a different kind of connection, and one that she actually begins to value by the end of the book.
Yeah, I think Vita is one of those characters that if she turned up on my doorstep, I can see why she would be appealing, but also what a pain she would be.
One of those sparkly people that you just need to speak to, but yeah, probably
yeah,
drive
you
her
want
mad
to
in
go
the end.
Home afterwards, and yeah, you want a bit of space. You don't want them to be your neighbour; that would be too much. It's far too much. So you mentioned that the novel's set in the late 80s. What was it that appealed to you about writing in that era?
There's, I suppose, two main reasons that I set it in the 80s. initially, and the predominant reason is that I wanted Sunday to experience and process her autism without access to the language and the contemporary theories around the condition. So I wanted her to exist in a way that was free of those things, and for other people to be judging her without that potential knowledge they would have now, to make her experience really pure, really internal, really unaffected by the way neurotypical people have translated the condition. That was my first reason. I just think it's more interesting and useful for it almost to exist in that vacuum in the book, so that Sunday can really be at one with it herself. And the other reason was that the 80s was very much a time of that sort of showiness and flashy excess that both Vita and Wallow bring. And I think portraying their class and wealth would be a more subdued process if I'd set it in the present time. But because it was the 80s, they're very showy and very unselfconscious about it. And that's one of the things that really dazzles Sunday. So I wanted it to be as big and glittery in that element as it could be.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just thinking now, if you'd set it in the present day, they'd have to all be all about like their Instagram profile and
Yes.
you
It'd be
know,
kind of
posting.
more sophisticated about the way they showed it as well.
Yeah, whereas 80s is like big earrings, big hair, you know, all the flashy clothes and stuff. So yeah, that, I think that would be a lot harder. You're right. And well, there's a certain, I guess there's a certain kind of nostalgic glamour to that period as well, which really works with the characters.
Yeah, I think so.
So tell us about the title. First of all, did you come up with the title, or was that a discussion with your editor? And also tell us about the kind of bird motifs throughout the novel, because there's a lot of descriptions about kind of people's voices being bird-like or their bodies being bird-like. Where did the kind of bird motif come from?
I suppose that came up quite early, the title. I was originally thinking about referencing the fires in the title, because the fires early on had been much more a factor in the novel for me. And the birds came a little bit later, but once the birds came in, I felt like that was where the title would be. And the title came from something that happened quite a few years ago. Some elderly neighbours that we had showed us around their very lovely garden, and in the garden they had what I thought was some kind of rabbit run or a dog run, but there was a bird trapped inside it. And when I asked them about the run, they said it was actually a trap, and it was called a Larsen trap. And the way it works is that one bird lives in the trap, and he calls other birds because they sing, obviously, and other birds come to investigate what he's doing. So he sings them down to him. And then when the visiting bird comes to investigate, he'd fall into the trap and be captured in a room separate from the original bird who called him down. And that way, the couple collected the birds, and then, shockingly, I was quite surprised, they strangled them at the end of the week and put them on a bonfire, because they were birds that these people considered garden pests. So I think people probably just don't do it so much anymore, but it was something that very serious gardeners sometimes did. And it was so shocking because we were in this beautiful garden and we could hear the birds singing, and it was all so lovely, but it was also, oh my God, this is such a
Very
shock.
dark.
Very dark, but I quite enjoy those moments in life where suddenly it's a sunny day, but everything has suddenly gone really dark. So that's why it really stayed in my head for a long time, and I was thinking about it. And then when I was thinking about Vita and to some extent Wallow as well, I was imagining them as that original bird that is in some ways a jailer, but also continues to use his beautiful song to call those around him to their demise. And so for that reason, when I thought about the Larsen trap, I really identified Vita as being that original bird that uses her charm to pull the others down, and they're sort of drawn to her. They don't know why or what's going to happen. But then, even when they're being carted off and strangled and burnt on the bonfire around her, she just keeps on singing. And with Sunday being someone who would identify as not having a song of any kind, because she doesn't see herself as having that charm, she'd be the most enthralled by Peter and her singing. So that's really where the idea for the bird and the bird hearts came from. And that's where my title came from. Yeah, from that day in the
That is
garden.
the best this like description or origin story of where a title's come from that I've ever heard. But
Oh.
how dark and creepy. I've never heard of this last entrap before. I mean, that's kind of horrifying, but a great bit of inspiration, I guess. I'm quite surprised that someone hasn't turned that into some human in a novel. I mean, a human sort of trap, that would be chilling.
I mean, yeah, it was one of those very strange moments, but they're the ones that stay with you, aren't they? And they're the ones that
Absolutely.
make you think afterwards, did that really just happen to me?
And great fodder for writing as well.
Definitely, yeah, it really, yeah, it was.
I just wanted to ask you about your kind of writing in general, because I think anyone who loves literary novels or novels with a great story but also beautiful prose would love your book, because you've got such a lyrical, beautiful way of writing. And I was wondering whether that's something that kind of comes to you naturally. Is that something that comes out in the first draft, or is that something you kind of have to work at in your edits? How is it for you?
When I'm beginning to write, I just write for myself. I don't think about an audience or necessarily about how it reads. And I don't ever expect it to make sense for a long time. So I don't mind writing quite an nonsensical kind of lyrical writing that doesn't necessarily have structure at the beginning. And then I think that's the most fun stage, that abstract stage. And then when it moves from being my own thoughts into something that's going to be shown to people, I think that's when the hard work begins. And I think that's the time when self-doubt can set in and slow you down. And I'm quite a slow writer at that stage. The beginning's easy, and then the bit where it's going to be read by other people is the part where I find myself really slowing down and becoming perhaps overly self-conscious about it. The thing I love about writing is how it just stays with me all the time. So if I'm working on a project, whatever I'm doing, the work's just always in my mind and always with me. So whatever else I'm experiencing, the writing just seems to inhabit that as well. And I love that because it's kind of like a form of mindfulness, I suppose, where can't worry about things and you can't focus on the wrong things because your mind's been overridden by this compulsion and this writing that you're focusing on. And so, for example, if I was writing and I'd been on that day when I went to the garden with the older people who had their last entrap, my mind would have been on fire with that because that would have immediately gone to the story I was writing and made all kinds of things make sense. So I love that feeling of connection that I have when I'm writing. And everything just seems more alive and more meaningful. So all the ordinary things that happen during the course of a day, when I'm writing, all those otherwise dull moments just are like fizzing with life. And that's the reason I write, I think, is that feeling.
So am I to take from that that you kind of love that early initial stage where you're just kind of writing with a blank page and you're not worrying about structure and any of this stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the same for you?
No, I hate the blank page. That's my worst part.
Oh, and you like it further down the line.
Yeah.
All right, we should swap
I
then.
like when I have something already and I know that I'm gonna kind of polish it and make it lovely. It's the first draft or the first pages where I know that I'm just pouring out kind of rubbish basically, and it needs work. But yeah, I can't relate.
Mom Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So what's your starting point then when you're working on something new? Does it kind of tend to start from an image? I mean, you said you started with the kind of fires. So is it kind of more of an image based starting point for you then?
I would say I'm quite visual in terms of story. And when I'm reading a book, I know I love those authors that even if they write in a quiet way, they really bring the image to life and I can see it while I'm reading it. So I love Penelope Mortimer, Richard Yates. I love Mrs. Bridge, the novel by Evan Connell. I love those books that just go a bit slower and really bring the setting and the people to life with, you know, extra detail and really a lot of language, a lot of dense language I like when I'm reading. So I aim to do that in my writing. And I think my images probably are fairly visual. And yeah, that's something that I think you like to write what you like to read, don't you? And so I think that's the style probably that I go for. That's where I find inspiration is mainly in images. Yeah, I think so.
When it comes to kind of the more boring structural stuff and the plotting, your book's a quite quiet book, but it does have a story to it and a narrative pull. How would you go about creating that in a much quieter book? Is that something you had to do like further down the line? Were you thinking of the kind of overall story arc when you started? What was the kind of process like for that?
I think because my book is character driven, essentially. I had the characters at the very beginning, they were quite strong for me in terms of, I felt like I knew a lot about the characters before I knew the plot. But the one thing I knew was that I wanted Sunday to go from initially being unsure about herself and very, have a lot of self-doubt about herself, and then to find somebody like Vita who she wants to model herself on, who she aspires to be like, but then ultimately to find that's disappointing. So I knew I had that sort of narrative arc that I had, Vita had to arrive as this very appealing person and then become something else. So I had that plot in mind. And as I began to write them, I realized how that would happen and what Vita would want from Sunday and what that would cost Sunday. So I think the characters, I knew the journey Sunday had to go on, and I knew the characters And that then is really what created the plot after that. So I would say that's how it went. And I knew the specifics sort of by halfway through the book. I was understanding how it was going to end. But I love Edith Wharton. And Edith Wharton in her art of fiction says that the first page should speak to the last page. So I'm always a bit suspicious if people don't know at all what they're going to write, because I think if you do that, how could the first page speak to the last page? But I already had the characters and I knew already roughly what would happen. So hopefully I achieved that. But I think I like that idea. I like the idea of having some kind of intention when you're writing. And I definitely had that intention.
Definitely. And I love what you say about the first and last page. And I think that is a kind of the mirror image of the beginning and ending is what I like as well. And
It's
when I,
satisfying, isn't it?
yeah, and I think as well, I remember receiving some writing advice that said, your ending should somehow mirror your opening in some way. And I think that was probably the most helpful advice that I had. And really clarified for me what my ending was going to be. So I think anyone struggling out there, kind of with their ending, kind of think about what your opening is and how you could twist it to make it a good ending.
And give your reader the satisfaction of knowing that they knew something all along. From the beginning, they knew something and that it wasn't fully formed to the end, but it was always there for them.
Definitely. So I want to talk a little bit about your kind of writing journey to get to this point. And I have to mention that you and I first met, I reckon it was about 10 years ago. And we both did an open university course. And then we ended up bumping into each other at the University of Kent. So I'd love to hear, for my nosiness as well as everyone else's, your kind of journey to publication. And I know you did a PhD. So tell us about kind of how you got to this point then. What was your writing journey like?
Okay. Well, first of all, I can't believe that was 10 years ago. And I remember it so well. I remember meeting you for the first time. I remember reading your work in the class. And I even remember the story that you wrote. I remember all
I
those
can't even
things.
remember that,
I remember it very well. But I can't believe it was so long ago.
I
It does seem like it really wasn't that long
know.
ago. So when I came to the university, I had done an access course. But I left school without any qualifications when I was 16. And then when my youngest children started school, I went back to education, did the access course. I did the Open University degree, which I really enjoyed. Did you enjoy doing that? It
Yeah, I loved it. Learned
was a
so
great
much.
experience. Yeah, me too. It was a really good experience for me too. And after that, I intended just to do the one degree. But then I loved it so much, I carried on and did the master's at Kent, where I met you again. And then during that master's course, I had the idea for this book. And I'd thought about doing a PhD by that point in Italian studies. And I had it sort of planned out. But I was distracted by thinking about this book. And I discussed it with Amy Sackville at the University of Kent. And I was really lucky that she became my supervisor, and then that book became the foundation for my doctoral research. The end of my PhD coincided with lockdown, and I finished my PhD during lockdown and submitted it. While I was waiting for the PhD examination, I sent my book to Jenny Hewson at Lutyens and Rubinstein, and she then signed me. And then just after I took the Viva, Jenny found publishers for the book. So still in lockdown, and yeah, all made lockdown a lot more interesting. But that happened at the very end of lockdown, and so I've been editing. I was editing after that to get the book ready for publication, and that's how it all happened. I didn't really know anything about the publication, the way it worked at all, but I just knew I had to get an agent if I was ever going to be published. So I thought I would try to get an agent. I hadn't expected while I was writing or doing the PhD that that's where I was heading, but it was like a lovely surprise at the end of the PhD to also have interest from an agent.
Absolutely. And if I have one criticism of Kent University, I would say like the master, certainly when I was there wasn't a lot of information about the publishing industry or how to get an agent or anything like that. And it is sort of, I mean, it apart from knowing that you've got to get an agent, it's quite a hard thing to navigate. And amazing that you kind of wrote to an agent. And was she the only one that you'd written to, or had you tried any others?
No, Jenny was the one that I wrote to, and because my master's was literature, I only did one creative writing section of it. So I hadn't done lots of creative writing during my master's, so I really had no understanding at all. I'd never considered being published or writing creatively in that way. So, yeah, I think I was just really fortunate. Yeah.
Also, not just luck, I mean talent as well. Come
Oh,
on.
well. Thank you, Chloe.
So, I mean, there's been loads recently in the kind of publishing press about how debut authors have had a difficult time with their mental health in their publishing year, and how challenging it can be to navigate the publishing industry. And certainly authors that I've interviewed have said they've found things challenging or difficult. And obviously for you, as a neurodivergent, there are other challenges facing you when you're working through the kind of publishing industry, because it's, and you know, sometimes a lot of weird email speak or very kind of opaque structures in the system. You know, I mean, even I find that when I started out, I was like, well, who do I email about this? And can I ask this question? And not knowing certain things. How's it been for you? And I was wondering whether there's anything kind of that you've experienced that you think that the industry could do better in terms of the kind of I guess the level of support that the industry might give authors that are neurodivergent. What's it been like for you?
I think this is a really good question because it is such an unknown territory. I think one of the problems with communication and with aiming to improve it is that often it's only much later that one realizes there's been a miscommunication or a misunderstanding. It's really rare at the time that you feel, I'm not getting this, can I have more clarification? So I think there's that kind of knowing afterwards, which makes things sometimes impossible to go back and unpick. I've been lucky with my publisher and my agent in that they're really clear. And because it was locked down initially when I met them and was starting to work on the book with them, all our communication was really by email. And as I've got older, I find it much easier to ask for really clear, direct instructions, and just to be very straightforward. Also, there's the case that other people are going to have their own ways of communicating and their own ways of emailing, their own language. So even if they're trying, there's sometimes that kind of wall between you. I think the most positive thing I can do is ask for real clarity in communication. And also, I just treat all emails and all texts, even really, like exam questions. So I take my time with them. I highlight the instructions. I break them down. And I really use all the study skills that I learned at the Open University, to make sure that I'm not going off on a tangent of my own, that I'm actually focusing on what's being asked. So, if I was going to be in a position to give advice, I would say to know yourself and your own communication style as much as possible. Take the time you need, and not to compare yourself to other people and their styles. I know sometimes I'll be going through an email and sending a really laborious, slow reply that might take me a few days to get right. Then my email goes off, and the person replies immediately. And I think that's like, are they wizards? How do they do that? How did they just write that email in 5 minutes as a response to what I've said? Because it does take me long, a really long time. So I think all you can do really is be accepting of that, those facts about yourself. And yeah, when it's something really important like work, Just to treat it like an exam question. I mean, I find emails more stressful than exams. So I might as well just get on the adrenaline and you treat it like I'm an exam, an exam situation. Yeah, I think that's a really good question. It's hard to break down how that could be applied for everyone, but I'm sure if people just have an idea of their own communication styles, those can always be, be improved and just give yourself time. Don't expect to do emails in a day if you find that element difficult, or whatever element of it is that you find difficult, give yourself the time to work through.
Is it something that you've kind of been open with your publishing team about as well? Because I've found that for a lot of writers who maybe do have whether they're disabled or chronically ill or whatever, seem to have the best experience when they've spoken to their agent or the team and said, look, I get very fatigued or whatever it is. Just I mean I'm my team's been fantastic in terms of saying to me, look, you've been in pain, don't do it, don't force yourself to respond to this if you're not in a good place, whatever. Have you found that they've been, I mean, it sounds like you've had a good experience with your team.
Yeah, and I'm happy that you've had that experience because it's so important, isn't it, to feel that you have that space to talk about your own needs. Yeah, my team's been really good. I think, yeah, it's a different experience for everyone, autism. And when I was talking to the publishers first, I really thought about the aspect of identifying as an autistic writer openly and what that would mean for me, because I think disclosure can be quite difficult, particularly, if I was a younger person at the or at the beginning of my career or my dating life, it would put me in a vulnerable position to disclose in such a public way. Yeah, but I felt it was important because I know when I'm reading, I love feeling that connection toward the autistic writers. So I felt that it was important to be open about it, although and it's not always an entirely positive thing to disclose. And obviously we're in a, competitive space writing, and you don't want to be slower or different or more demanding. So yeah, it's never an entirely straightforward decision or process, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the publishing, well, the post-publication experience for you then. What's been the best part of being a published author so far?
I think as a parent, I have neurotypical children and autistic children, and I'm really happy to have shown them that it's possible to do the things that you care about. And for me, that wasn't necessarily being published because I didn't always have that idea that that was what I was aiming for. But more about getting my degrees, and not that academics is the most important thing, but having left school at 16 without any qualifications, my children knew about that, and they also knew how much I love books and literature, and I'm just generally very bookish, and yet I had nothing to show for it. So I'm glad to have bridged that gap and shown them, that the autism hasn't stopped me from pursuing those things that I really care about. And that's something I'm really grateful to have shown them. So that's definitely one of the best things. The other best thing probably is that my husband's always been really supportive about the writing, and also my supervisor, Amy Sackville, at the University of Kent. They both always just felt like of course I was going to write a book, even on the days that I really didn't think I was going to write a book. So I always appreciated that, and it's great to say to those two people, look, you were right and I was wrong. Thank you. Thanks for their belief. Because that's really helpful, isn't it, when you're writing? Do you find that?
Yeah, you do need those people in your life, particularly I think when you're having a day where you just can't see the wood for the trees and you're like, I'm never going to finish this. What's the point? You need those people that believe in you and think you have it in you. And Amy Sackville for me was one of those people as well, because she was one of my tutors at Kent, and And when I was writing, short stories at the time, and she turned around and said to me, "This isn't a short story, this is a novel." And I was like, "Oh, I'm not writing that. It's too hard. No way." And then I was like, "Well, if she thinks I can do it, then maybe I should try." And here we are. So we both have a lot to thank Amy for, which is lovely.
Yeah, it's that thing of having a writer and a writer whose work I love saying, "I like what you're writing." And that's so important, isn't it? It's like transforming, especially when you're having difficult days and you don't feel like it's going anywhere. Just having that validation from someone who you admire is transforming.
Yeah, particularly as well as often as writers, we live so much in our own heads, and mm-hmm. it's hard sometimes to step away from that and think, is it any good? I've got no idea.
Yeah.
And particularly when we're starting something new. And on that topic, finally, I have to ask you, can you give us any kind of hint about what's next for you? What are you working on at the moment? Give us a little teaser.
So I'm roughly working on two projects. One is about a woman who is recently widowed and then finds out her husband is not who she had thought he was. And she has to review their life and consider the part she played in enabling his bad behaviours. So I'm writing that. And I'm also writing about a semi-famous woman who became sort of famous in the 1970s. And I've always felt she was very misrepresented and been a bit obsessed with her. So I'm writing about her in a more sympathetic way. And I'm really enjoying writing that. And I'm not 100% convinced either the project's super commercial or necessarily books, but I'm just enjoying writing both of them, to be honest, because they're both, especially the second idea, it's just very personal to me and just something I'm fascinated by. So it's always easier to write something that you're very interested in, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they both sound great to me. So I hope at least one of them emerges at some point.
We'll see.
Victoria, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks, Chloe. It was so nice to catch up and speak to you.
That was Victoria Lloyd Barlow talking about her literary novel, All the Little Bird Hearts, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.